Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Westminster Abbey. My name is Paul Bauman. I'm the chair of the Institute. I also am the Receiver General here at the Abbey, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you on behalf both of the Institute and of the Dean and Chapter of the Abbey to this, the final event in what has turned out to be rather an exciting series of explorations of that interesting combination between the arts and public service. We've had so far three fascinating dialogues between a judge and an artist, a civil servant and the Abbey's organist, and last week a politician and a poet. If you missed them, by the way, they are now available on the website in podcast form, and I'm reliably assured that videos of these events will be on the website very shortly as well. So it's not too late to experience what was really quite a fascinating set of conversations between some exciting people. Those dialogues focused primarily on the similarities and differences, and I assure you there were many of both of those, between the creation and delivery of art on the one hand, in its many forms, and the ways in which public servants approach their work. But they have also pointed up a number of ways in which the arts in themselves can influence our national life and culture. And it's that aspect which we're going to explore in today's symposium with our three eminent speakers. A theologian, a writer, and I think, John, it's best to describe you as an impresario, but you may have better terms for yourself in due course. You can find the biographies of Ben Quash, Marina Warner, and John Gilhooly amongst the papers on your seats, and in a moment they'll each offer us some food for thought on today's topic before moving into discussion amongst themselves and indeed with you. Just a quick word, as usual, about the setting for today's session. Cheney Gates, where you are, dates back to the 14th century, but it was extensively rebuilt after bomb damage during the war, which affected a number of buildings across the Abbey precincts. It was historically part of the Abbot's House, obviously subsequently, therefore, the deanery. It's had many colourful visitors over that time, including Henry VII, who often dined with Abbot Islip here, doubtless taking the opportunity to check on the progress of his chapel at the east end of the Abbey. And indeed Sir Thomas More, who had perhaps less lavish hospitality when he was incarcerated here before being sent off to the Tower. So you're in good company, depending on how you think of those particular people. An ideal space for the sort of deep thought and interesting conversation that we have on offer today, and I'll leave you to form your own judgment about the quality of the hospitality. Given our focus on the arts, I should perhaps also say that the paintings you see around you are by Alex Cresswell, completed over a period of about 6 years and brought together last year in this space. He describes his creative inspiration thus: in the light of summer, the greater spaces reverberate bright sunlight and the air is shot through with rays of optimism. I aspire to float in space, to soar like a bird high above it all. Great architecture, art and music enable me to do just that. In my early days, I chose to paint the safer subjects, the tranquility of the cloister, sheltering doorways and quiet corners, and these then gave me the strength to take on the sublimity of the place, and in so doing, perhaps better to understand the glory of God. So we are again in good company on the walls, and I leave you to enjoy the results of his work as you listen to our speakers. And now, with no further ado, I'll invite Professor Ben Quash to lead us into the discussion. Ben.
Thank you very much, Paul, and it's very nice to see so many of you here. The relating of art to public good is quite a challenging thing. I often think, as somebody who teaches in a theology and religious studies department, that the term art is rather like the term religion, in that it's a catch-all term, an umbrella term, and the sheer variety of things that are meant to be captured under it are so diverse that when you look at them closely, they start just to move in all kinds of different directions. So any account of what art does immediately becomes problematic, not least because there are so many different varieties of arts, different art forms or genres of art, plastic, performative, and so on, but also because even within each of those subdivisions, they can be put to multiple uses, and indeed the question of whether they have uses at all is a real question and something that can cause quite a lot of vigorous debate. But it's something I think we at least need to entertain in a society that does put public money towards the support of the arts. The idea that they do something worthwhile for our collective good seems at least to be implied in the fact that they are the recipients of public money. So those are those kinds of background questions, I suppose, which will be in all of our minds as we ask the particular questions that we are facing today. And as somebody also who works in a university context and who's witnessing some of the very extraordinary transformations that are going on in universities at the moment, I think this is a very relevant and urgent question to be asking, not only about art or the arts, but about the arts and humanities more generally. So for me, part of the passion I feel about this question has to do with seeing the way that universities themselves are largely for economic reasons and political ones that are allied to those economic reasons, are being required more and more to justify what they teach with very specific reference to use, to utile questions, questions of utilitarian value. Often that boils down to economic value. And that does put the arts and humanities in a rather difficult position. And I expect we'll hear more about this from Marina and John. The mode in which increasingly university education is being asked to deliver itself has to do with, if one's using an analogy with the modes of speech, to do with the indicative and the imperative to some degree. So it's very often we're being required to announce what is the case in the world, and the subjects that seem most robustly and objectively and unequivocally to tell you what is the case are the subjects that are doing better, because they can prove, they have, as it were, benchmarks that allow them to prove that they are delivering this kind of objective and measurable truth, this information about what is the case. And allied with that is there's the ought, which is how we therefore ought to put what we know to be the case to use in order to serve a particular set of ends. And that's the imperative mode, the ought that goes along with it. Now, those, of course, are timeless philosophical concerns, and how they relate to each other is a very long-standing philosophical question. How do the is and the ought relate? What worries me about the way in which they're presented and indeed rendered manifest in the context of a university curriculum is the absence of consideration of desire. So if I want to strike a keynote in what I say now, it's about the irreducible importance of desire in all that we do, and the way in which the arts have a particular relationship to our desiring, that aspect of us as individuals but also as a society that is moved by desire. And if we're not frankly moved, then we will do nothing. Nothing will happen unless we're first moved by something. So even the prioritisation of disinterest in, let's say, the study of certain subjects at university, the proper and indeed the way in which law courts operate and certain kinds of political deliberation operate, that proper celebration of disinterest in certain contexts is nevertheless underpinned by an interest in disinterest. So when we are acting disinterestedly in public life, in the administration of the law, and also in the teaching of certain kinds of subjects, we do have an interest in disinterestedness. You can never eliminate desire from that kind of inquiry. And we do well to remind ourselves of what it is that we most profoundly and most properly desire in all that we do. And I think that the arts have a crucial role to play in helping us ask what do we most profoundly and what do we most properly desire. Now, that's to operate at sort of 20,000 feet and to say certain things that then would have to be run through all kinds of particular tests and challenges if one were looking at particular examples of works of art. And it's easy to say that it all has to do with desire. And I'll be interested to know whether you respond well to that or how you might challenge it. But of course, there are a whole panoply of things that, in particular, the arts do in relation to our desires. I think they can, they don't always, but they can require of us a certain kind of quality of attention that's something that we can be trained in. It's a discipline. So they, as it were, ask things of us or even demand things of us that require us to acquire virtues. And the virtues of attention or attentiveness are very important ones, I think, very often. I think very often, too, the arts can help to foster in us qualities of empathy, because they are communicative disciplines. making is a communicative act in whatever medium, whether it's in music, literature, painting or whatever. There is an act of communication, I would suggest, that is intrinsic to what's going on. That's a non-accidental part of what artistic activity is, and so the receiving of or responding to art is a response to a communicative act and actually makes us part of an event of communication. And empathy is a good quality to have if you're going to be involved in communication. You come to a fuller appreciation of the other who addresses you in whatever form. There are ways by which I think the arts can be a preparation for death. We might think of the memento mori tradition, but there are many ways in which I think reflecting upon the arts is a good way in which we prepare for our own death. It's also a way of celebrating life, of course, and entertainment has a place in the arts. Entertainment is part of that celebratory mode in which we relate to the arts. There are very, very influential accounts of art that suggest that it's a form of escape or transcendence from some of the problematic aspects of our more immediate and material world. I've just come from teaching a class in King's to my MA students about Arthur Schopenhauer, and Schopenhauer has the very definite view that the arts are a mode of escape to the truer and transcendent realm of the pure will, which isn't actually a particularly pleasant one at all in Schopenhauer's view, and I still don't understand, I read him every year in preparation for the class, why he thinks we should strive so hard to escape to this more real realm in which everything is just equally horrible. But there are other modes than Schopenhauer's of suggesting that the arts allow us to transcend aspects of our present reality. I personally am somewhat suspicious of those. I think escapism isn't necessarily the best way in which the arts can serve our collective good, but there it is. And I think a last thing I would suggest, and of course I could go on, is the fact that the arts in a certain way are vehicles of tradition. And that's something that we perhaps feel a little bit uncomfortable about in the present day, because traditions very often have been exposed as being riddled with problematic prejudices or political decisions made in the past, embodied in the statuary in our public squares, which we feel uncomfortable about now in our present circumstances. But I would still want to defend the positive role of the arts as carriers of certain kinds of tradition. They can only mean, because they have inherited certain things. Of course, they can improvise, vary, and in some ways challenge what they've inherited. But artistic communication, like language itself, is always first the inheritor of something that's been passed on. And if we want the arts to continue to flourish, we also have to have a sense of how we are part of a tradition, not only receiving, but transmitting or handing on to others. And that, I think, is place where we perhaps can most confidently articulate questions of public good in relation to the arts, and that particular note of tradition. And for me, a touchstone for this idea is St. Augustine of Hippo, the 4th and very early 5th century bishop and theologian from North Africa, whose work, The City of God, articulates a theory of what makes a society work at all and makes it cohere. And desire comes back here as a crucial part of it, because Augustine adapts a definition of society that's there in Cicero. Cicero had said that a society is a community that's bound together by common rights and common interests. Common rights and common interests. And Augustine's own version of this is to say that a society is a multitude of people who are bound together by their common objects of love, by their desire to share the things they love. And that, for me, is a very good definition of society, and one that I think faces certain challenges in a situation where we don't know what we have in common, or we're very uncertain about claiming that we have anything in common because of the ways in which that might seem to be rather an imperialistic claim, to be imposing on others a set of sort of canonical reference points, whether artistic or in terms of ideas or religious traditions, that everyone is in some way meant to look to for their unity. But if we have no sense of common objects of love, things that we share together, then I think as a society we're in really deep trouble. So, to sum up that, I think what I'd want to say is that we neglect desire at our peril. The arts are our friends in putting us in touch with our desires and helping us to sift those desires, and that a proper relationship to those desires collectively, because they must be held in common, is something that is a necessary condition for our social flourishing. And the way in which the sign-making that goes on in art is both a representation of what we most desire and what we want to share with one another as we try to live in common with one another. The ways in which they both represent that, but also help us to form ourselves together in relation to those signs, to transform us towards our common life together, means that they are essential to the public good and have a proper place in the public square. That, I think, is what I want to say, at least to begin with, and I look forward to hearing from the other two.
Thank you, Ben. Very, very helpful. Marina, please.
Well, I'm very much in agreement with Ben, though I'm actually very curious and would like to know, perhaps later you can tell us what words actually Augustine used for... You're using desire. I think I would have used
love.
Pleasure.
Mm.
But what word he used for love, I think that's sort of...
I'm going to have to go and get my notes for that.
Sorry. Because actually Latin has quite a number of different words, more than we do in some ways. So, well, I think that what Ben said actually points to one of the deep difficulties we have. And that is that because the arts and humanities have been underprivileged compared to the STEM subjects, it's not actually acknowledged how deeply entangled they are. Because you actually can't make a decision about what you're going to experiment in your lab unless you share the values of the community in which that experiment is taking place. And in order to know those values, you have to have been exposed to the whole tradition of thinking which comes down through culture. So, and this goes across the board for, even in mathematics, This is the case. The kinds of problems that you set yourself arise out of the collective questions of the community. And you will be in a very dangerous situation if you don't have the cultural bedrock that you actually... And if your next generations don't have that cultural bedrock. You know, it's one thing to go to the moon, but quite another thing to start thinking about euthanasia. So we have to have this constant conversation, which is a cultural conversation. Now, I was a sort of bookworm, and, you know, I was somebody who went to university and so forth, but I've actually come to see, you know, against my own formation, that there is a whole incredible vigour in something that is much less scholastic. And I would like quite to keep the arts a little bit separate, actually, from the idea of education. I think they are public service, and of course they have an educational effect, as absolutely goes without saying. But I don't think they should be seen as part of the same process. Because your point about desire, which I would call pleasure, is absolutely key, and it's related to play, to spontaneous play, to making the possibility, creating the access in many, many different physical ways to the idea of playing. So the kind of thinking that, you know, I'm now developing, it was based on someone like D.W. Winnicott, the psychoanalyst, and also people, urbanists, like Lewis Mumford, thinking about cities and how we live in them. And Winnicott said, you know, playing is reality. A child develops because they are able to imagine things, and then with a leaf and a stick and a cup, they can make a boat, they can make a story about the ocean and so forth. So the first time I saw this, it was many years ago when there was still more money. I mean, you mentioned there was public money, but there's very niggardly public money. But there was more public money, and I was asked to write an opera libretto for children for the Linnean Baylis Outreach program, which was associated with the English National Opera. And we were to work with 10 primary schools in inner London. And it turned out that though the addresses were very grand addresses, the mothers and fathers of these children actually were mostly working in the hotels and offices as cleaners. So they would bring the children in early in the morning. So these children were from absolutely all over the world. They had many languages together and so forth. To begin with, during these rehearsals, they were tiny little things like this. They didn't hardly knew where their arms could stretch. And honestly, by the end of 3 weeks, they were transformed by this experience, and they were having such a wonderful time. And in the meantime, they were learning English, because they had to. They were learning to move. They were learning to have confidence, to talk to each other. So there were many, many side effects. I mean, having said that, I don't believe it should, I think it should be kept separate from schools. Of course, this was in the context of schools, but we were doing it outside in sort of halls and things. And eventually, they did actually put on a performance in the ENO. And they adored dressing up. They loved helping paint the masks, the sets, and so forth. So, and that converted me completely to the idea that we don't have to have book learning to begin with to create community, that what you need to have is creative knowledge. You have to have your curiosity fed and met by responsive situations in which, and above all, that you are not alone. You do this collectively, you do this collaboratively. So again, it's a little bit different from the fine arts, which tend to be virtuoso, very gifted people. This is much more sort of broad. This is not the X factor. You know, it's not looking for talent. It's actually looking for a way of creating collective responses, friendships. And actually, since that little experiment that I was involved in, the problem has got more acute because of social media, because now the isolation of young people is greater because they're on their plugged in and constantly reminded of their own personality, their own developing set facade or persona. Whereas what happens in this kind of activity, and you hinted at that, is there is an ideal of self-forgetfulness. Ideally, if you really get involved in an arts project and you're playing with your peers or with others, you actually forget for a moment what you look like, you know, what you have that delightful, that absolutely deep pleasure, which if any of you, you know, have had it, it's just the most wonderful thing when you actually forget yourself completely for 2 hours because you're making something, you know, making a pot or whatever, making a mask. So I started working with refugees in Sicily, and the question in 2016, because as a writer, I wanted to see if there was a way that literature could actually become part of a community, building a community for people who've just arrived, who've lost a lot in wars and famine and drought and so forth. And at the moment, most people work with refugees with music and art because the language feels very alien because many of them speak other languages and it's hard to communicate. But I try to look at with friends, the traditions of creating collective stories without words or with very few words. And it so happens that Sicily, where many of these refugees have arrived, thousands actually, 700,000 when I last looked, have arrived, has a very long tradition of puppetry. And puppetry is one of the major world art expression, forms of expression that does not necessarily involve a lot of words, but is completely very easy to do, as it were. I mean, obviously some puppeteers are better than others, but not difficult to do. It's not difficult actually to make puppets. You could almost make them with anything to hand, napkins and cotton reels. And you can and then animate the stories. So we started doing it. I suppose it has the following principles, this project, which is called Stories in Transit, which are different from some of the other projects. First of all, we don't ask for them to express themselves in an articulate way if they can't. Then we don't actually ask them about themselves, because there's a lot of, I think, intrusive interviewing of refugees and asylum seekers. And a lot of them have been through sheer hell. And it's not very nice when strangers say, well, just tell me how you were raped. Was it really like that? No, tell me a bit more. I mean, so we avoid that. And we just try to invent stories together. And they've themselves set up their own workshop, which is called Jokerenda, which means in Fula, which is a West African word, means negotiation and collaboration. And in Italian, it sounds like playing, giocare being Italian for play. So the word, by adventitiously, purely unexpectedly, actually has this double meaning. And they've been given, as a result of their activities, which are storytelling in schools, using some of these methods, and storytelling in the street, and in games that they've actually created, and they've made themselves, they sell them, and they've been given money locally, and for an office in Palermo, in one of the main squares, so they'll be on the tourist route. And this is really a major achievement of theirs. I mean, they've now got sort of semi-papers, you know, terribly long process to get actual status, but they're sort of permitted to remain. And all the games they make are non-competitive, and so they don't need anybody to be brilliant. They're all collaborative games. And I think this method of, this idea of play slightly reverses the idea of teaching, because it actually, or the way teaching is now conducted, I'm not criticizing it, it can happen in schools, but this is the idea that you discover as you go. So you're not told how to do something. You play a game in which you're asked to imagine a character, and you draw it or do it in some way that if it doesn't, you don't have enough words. And then you're given some scraps of things and try to make the cut puppet of that character. So it's a process of learning as you go rather than being told how to do something. The other thing that I think relates to what Ben was saying is that the religious community has developed over the centuries, over the millennia, absolutely sort of wonderful ways of people being together and feeling better. And a lot of these have actually been adapted by the artists today. A lot of visual artists, a lot of performance artists, theatre artists, and so forth. So there has been developing a phenomenon of secular assembly, secular processions, that not necessarily denominational. I mean, that some people in the crowd may be religious. A lot of the refugees are Muslims, and they are pious. They're not fundamentalists, but they're pious. They pray. But this idea of, and so some of the things that we've been doing in Palermo that are the most successful are these processions with banners and carrying the characters to the next place where the puppet play will be put on, and bringing in the bystanders. You know, they say, "What are you doing? Come and see, come and see." So this idea of you know, what was I as a Catholic was brought up constantly in processions. I never got to be the person I wanted most to be, which was the person strewing rose petals in front of the Eucharist. And I totally agree with you about cultural memory, because what happens is that though they're not asked, these refugees don't tell us their personal stories. They, of course, put their personal stories and their personal experiences into the material they're inventing. But at the same time, they're bringing, and they're rather surprised that we value it. They bring their own cultural memories, songs they knew from, and we don't ask them to be authentic recorders of their cultures, which is a sort of more strict multicultural idea of it, but more to do with the fusion that, okay, we'll take that bit from your song, and we'll turn it into a Sicilian song with this Sicilian tune as well. So that's there's a kind of encounter and meeting point and an idea of that we are in a state of flow and a state of flux. And then the other thing that I think is quite important in terms of the arts, because of access, and you know, though it has got much better, museums are not feeling quite so forbidding, and people are very much brought, in schools, are very much brought to museums. But nevertheless, I do think that the loss of the youth club has been a catastrophe. And that actually started under the Labour government long ago. They closed the youth clubs. And we need something equivalent to that. We need safe play spaces, both indoors and outdoors, that are drop-in, that are pop-up, that allow for scraps of materials, sort of almost jumble sale type things that can be made, be used for collective imaginative play. And the reason, I'm just finished with the main reason for this imaginative play, is to establish a sense of relations between people. Because we are suffering, as we all know, from a crisis in racism, multifaceted, not only anti-Semitism, but many, many other forms of racism. And we need to have confrontations and exchanges between different communities laid down in youth. And it does happen. I mean, I'm quite optimistic. I mean, in this city, we're quite good. It's, many, many young people are much less prejudiced than old people. But I'll end there.
Thank you very much, Marina. John.
Well, I'm going to end up echoing a lot of what's been said before, but in a slightly more practical way. I join you today as a musician who happens to have a degree in political science, and it's the first time that I've ever spoken in public using both disciplines. I'd like to begin by taking you back to the year 1813, when remarkably there was no orchestral presence here in London. Yet the citizens of London loved music and comprised of very many talented musicians. There were musical influences, of course, both sacred and secular in the centuries before, going back to William Byrd and the Chapel Royal and Handel around Hanover Square. Both enjoyed royal patronage, and both were probably public servants for music. And, of course, there was music in churches right across London, but there was no coherent way forward. In 1813, there was no such thing as a national arts policy, no digital or audience data like we have today, no focus groups, no policy lab at the Cabinet Office, no Arts Council, no Charity Commission, no DCMS. Some would see this as utopia. Certainly no dialogue about the arts and public service like we're having here today. On the plus side, there were no cumbersome Arts Council application forms with their unique oblique language or published targets to meet or pressure to prove that our arts should have a social value beyond excellence to justify its subsidy or its existence. And unlike nowadays, there was no debate about backing the arts that pay as opposed to overlooking or neglecting the arts that cost. So in 1813, despite the lack of a cultural infrastructure, and thankfully, in the absence of agency interference, a group of enlightened citizens decided to take action. And as distinguished architects under royal instruction, such as John Nash, were shaping the very heart of the capital, running from Piccadilly to the Regent's Park, those music-loving citizens somehow put themselves right at the heart of the conversation by founding the Royal Philharmonic Society to present a series of concerts in the Argyle Rooms on Regent Street. It's now the NatWest Bank on Regent Street, by the way. It hovers over Oxford Street Tube Station and was the home of the London premiere some years later of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which was commissioned by the Philharmonic Society here in London for £50, probably the best £50 ever spent in classical music, despite being roundly condemned by the critics at its Oxford Circus premiere. But by creating the Philharmonic Society, those citizens created a lasting culture. As a policy decision, if you want to call it that, it's had a pretty long lifespan. And that was the real kickstarter for orchestral life in this country. Mendelssohn, Schumann, both Clara and Robert, Wagner, Grieg and Debussy, to name but a few, were all quickly associated with this new society. And over the next 100 years, many orchestras were created and found their footing, and eventually the society was able to pull back and focus on other activities. So the society somehow, without government support or instruction, began to prove classical music's rightful and powerful place at the heart of our national life, and that's something that we continue to champion in 2019 more than ever. It's also worth noting that by the year 1900, on that route from Piccadilly to Regent's Park, there were no fewer than 4 concert halls, all part of the grand plan at the time, sadly all now gone, including the Queen's Hall, the original home of the Proms, which was bombed during the Second World War. A few enlightened individuals just got on with things in a way they were unpaid public servants, unpaid policymakers, just a plucky band of music lovers and musicians who wanted to change the game. The art itself, great music, led the way, and without any overriding policy. The classical music tradition, which we know today, took off and began to spread nationally from the heart of London. Of course, we all know that art is better served with and supported by some form of governance or national policy. but that policy should not get in the way of the art itself. And I'm not suggesting that we don't need national agencies or public servants to oversee our art. Far from it. But we have to acknowledge that the dialogue between the arts and policymakers, between the arts and government, is still at times very difficult, full of misunderstanding and lost opportunity on both sides. And as the master of the system is the Treasury, which decides the spending allocation for each ministry, it favours those who achieve their targets. And ministers are in turn expected to develop their own process of contract and audit, and the agencies they sponsor, DCMS and the Arts Council, being no exception to that rule. And that target-oriented culture gets passed down all the way to individual artists, who sometimes view this with great suspicion. As it's election time, I've sought out the arts policies in each of the party manifestos, and I really had to seek them out, because nobody's talking about the arts in public in this election, and unfortunately, that's nothing new. Even though the cultural sector is amazingly valuable to the economy of the country and to our international brand, I might be wrong, but politicians seem to view us as a minority and perhaps an endangered minority. And very few politicians are going to shout loudly about so-called elitist entertainment or art. So, unfortunately, we're still in an era when the spin doctors think that real people only go to football or watch pop concerts. And artists have no clue as to what policy is, how it's formed, and the process for creating it. So there's misunderstanding all around us. And there's a particular prejudice that politics and the arts should have very little to do with each other. The reality is that they have many important common points of intersection. They're both greatly concerned with values, with integrity, and with trying to influence and to change minds. And in an ideal world, politics and the arts try to shape society's wider culture. They're not just a way of life, but in many ways, the very organizing of life itself. Not many people outside of Whitehall are aware of the heartening and important work being taken on by Policy Lab at the Cabinet Office, which brings much needed fresh experimental thinking into the UK government. Policy Lab looks at how policy making should not only be formed by research and facts and figures, but by measurable or measurable outcomes, but argues that the emotional, the instinctual, the instinct, and even the irrational have always had a place in decision making. And I began by telling you the story of the foundation of orchestral life in this country 200 years ago. I think the nation loves stories, and we make decisions when we react to our gut. Something either feels right or wrong, depending on how it's put before us, how the story is told. And both previous speakers use the word story quite a lot through their narrative. So any government policy, be it arts or otherwise, should recognize the value of an emotional appeal, and that simple stories draw attention to and perhaps help us to answer very complex problems. Facts and figures are just one part. We do not act on facts and figures alone. We are all of us inspired to act by emotional, physical, and other experiences. Great art and great music affects us deeply and touches something human and personal and strikes at the very heart of our emotions. When Beethoven sat down to write his Ninth Symphony, he was faced with a blank canvas, as every artist is. He delivered it a few years late, by the way, so it was a very blank manuscript for quite a while. When he sat down to write the Pastoral Symphony, I very much doubt that he would have seen that work as some of us see it now, clearly signalling him as one of the world's early environmentalists. He was composing a policy position without even realising it. Nor could he have imagined that the Ode to Joy in the Ninth Symphony, paid for by public collection here in London, would become the rallying call for Europe over the last decades, and now, unfortunately, a divisive tune in this nation. So lessons for the arts can also provide a real role in all sorts of policy making. And I don't have to tell anybody who's familiar with Beethoven, particularly late Beethoven, his late string quartets or his piano sonatas, how complex and how difficult these works are. But every time I hear these works, which is many times, hundreds of times in my lifetime, I've struggled with Beethoven's puzzles. And perhaps we're not really meant to fully understand such divinely inspired music. But every time I listen and I try to understand the complexities, it makes me into a more open-minded human being, a better manager, a better strategic thinker, and a better leader. And I'm not alone in thinking that the study of the arts gives us a much more rounded approach to our life and our work. And we should stand up to those who seek to relegate or belittle humanities, particularly at university level, saying that it's of no use or importance. I also believe that professional arts leaders have to master a wide complexity of skills in their working life, many of which are outside the brief of ordinary business leaders. And this makes arts leaders uniquely placed to transfer to public leadership for the benefit of all. Many arts leaders could bring a fresh perspective to social and economic leadership. And many artists and musicians could do the same, particularly at non-executive level. And public servants, too, can and must provide even more valuable informal or formal advice at board level in the arts. So as an artistic director who programs 500 concerts a year at Wigmore Hall, I need to be alert and open to what's going on at all the major venues and festivals in the world at all times. And we need to collaborate and share with each other and to inspire each other. And I'm deeply impressed by the work Carnegie Hall is undertaking with young offenders, particularly around the time of their first offence, working closely with the police and with law enforcement. Through a partnership with Arts for Incarcerated Youth, Carnegie Hall has come together to consider how music, and I mean music, any type of music, can be used in juvenile justice settings. The goal is to advance reform amongst young offenders through the power of the arts, and it's already proving that a lot of these kids don't re-offend. I visited the leader's office in the very deprived borough of Barking on Monday to talk about bringing a similar scheme there with Wigmore Hall. And I was very impressed with how that borough has instilled culture and identity and sense of place and storytelling and community pride right through the council. And I found a very open door. I've also been impressed in recent years by Saffron Hall and Saffron Walden, which is a trailblazing model of state, school and community music provision, producing outstanding results with world-class artists and inspiring through music and the arts, representing unique values and proof that anyone can access world-class music in the arts and anyone can aspire to perform at the highest level. This sort of endeavour should be repeated right across the country, and it's truly extraordinary that such life-enhancing work is taking place in a state school setting. So by giving children and families ownership of the arts, as we've heard already in culture, they feel more confident in their ability to create, to challenge, to explore, and to be part of a society that can make change happen. And tragically, children denied access to the arts can feel locked out and often left behind. And I believe it's vital to enable people at all stages of life, regardless of their circumstance or background, to take part in cultural activity. And that's what Saffron Walden is proving now as a community. But this sort of policy needs national centralised thinking, which is government-led. As individual arts organisations, we can only do so much. The LSO, the Royal Opera House, the Royal Shakespeare Company, Wigmore Hall, we can only reach tens of thousands of people, of young people every year and bring them the arts. There are millions of disenfranchised. There's youth across the country. It's not a joined-up policy. We're just a sticking plaster, in effect. And somebody really needs to look at that. We must do better at making art available and our work available. And tomorrow night, I will present the gold medal of the Royal Philharmonic Society, which is one of the oldest and probably one of the high, it is probably the highest honour in classical music, to Sofia Gudbidelina, who's an 88-year-old half-Tartar, half-Slavic musician, and very much influenced by the Russian Orthodox faith. And as I prepare the citation, I found a quote from her, which I think is very appropriate. She says, "I am a religious person, and I understand religion in the literal meaning of the word as religio, that is to say, the restoration of connections, the retying of a bond, the restoration of the legato in life. Life divides humanity into many pieces. There is no weightier occupation than the recomposition of spiritual integrity through the composition of music." So perhaps we should all contemplate on those words as we form our own stories and our own narratives as public servants or as artists. Music is the art of the things that we cannot see or touch. It's about feelings and thoughts and offerings of generosity, and it tends to teach us about our connections and voices from other countries and eras, and it urges us to tell and to get together to form a collective story. And there I leave it.
Thank you very much. So I have to tell you, John, you've just ruined completely what I was going to ask you to do now by bringing together in such a brilliant way the stories that have been told and this whole issue of binding up and connecting through the power that you've all talked about of the arts to do that was really where I was going to invite you to reflect together for a moment or two. How can it, at a time when we are desperately in need of truth, reconciliation, binding together, common culture, real empathy, etc., what are the practical things that could now be done? And who are the equivalents of the enlightened individuals you talked about back in the 1800s that we now have that can step forward and do that? So I wonder whether, just for a few minutes before we turn to the audience and their questions, you could think about the things that have resonated with each of you in what the others have said, but think perhaps in that context as to how the impact of the arts can be most maximised. But maybe we could start with you, Ben, to pick up some of those threads.
I'm not sure I can rise to that level of that high-order question, but I was very struck by Marina's account of her work in Palermo and the sense of how the importance of art becomes very acutely visible in cases of displacement or exile. And it reminded me of a line in Psalm 73 when the psalmist is speaking precisely from a context of exile in Babylon and says, "We see not our signs." And that's a lament, "We see not our signs." Mm-hmm. And so the question of what our signs are is one displaced people particularly remind us to think about. Mm-hmm. But actually, all of us need to be thinking about it. And in some ways, actually, I think we're all, in a certain sense, in a certain condition of exile at the moment, because and looking for our signs. So part of the task of making these new connections, and that's a great picking up of the etymology of religion, that these ligaments that we need in order to flourish. Part of the task is to think together about what our signs are, because we are a collective first person only when we have those sorts of shared signs, which is to echo Augustine again. That's as far as I can get just right now. But it does raise actually the question of patronage. You said, who are these individuals, which is interesting, and whether that's now that's quite a traditional model of how the arts have flourished, whether we need to think in those terms again or still is something I'd be interested to hear from Marina and John, because part of what the state has been, it has been at certain times, is a patron. But part of what we're seeing is that it isn't necessarily doing that job now. I think that's come out quite clearly in several things that have been said. Is the answer to go back to the beneficent individual, or some combination, or to call the state back to something that it might be neglecting improperly, or some combination of those? But that really is a policy question that's above my pay grade.
Oh, come.
Yeah. Well, I think both of you have drawn attention to the idea of place, and I think that music is very related to place. I mean, in the sense that if you are displaced, you can bring tears to one's eyes, can't it? If you hear a piece of music and you remember where you were when you heard that and so forth. So, and people carry songs with them in the same way as they carry memories of their actual physical home. I mean, a song is a kind of home. It can be used for wicked nationalist, very nationalist, aggressive purposes, but not always at all. There's a wonderful YouTube online of Riccardo Muti taking Va Pensiero, and the Israelite captives in Nabucco, the chorus begins to cry, and then Riccardo Muti stops them and says, "I think we'll take it again," in the middle of the Scala opera, because this song, Va Pensiero, is a song of the exiles protesting their state, and that's not the national anthem of Italy, but a sort of place where the Italians feel themselves at home in the song. And stories also create familiarity with place, so that the whole principle of pilgrimage, the idea that a place has these memories, even if they're no longer visible, that's something that also culture creates. It endows the landscape, even a grim landscape. I mean, think of how L.S. Lowry has absolutely transformed the experience of the mills. I mean, his paintings have made them part of the English traditional, you were talking about tradition, English traditional memory, transvalued them. Horrible to live in at the time, very grim for him to paint, no doubt. He was not a happy man himself, but what he's given us is a transfigured experience of that stream in English life, which mattered because that was the wealth of the cotton mills, which made our cities. So this role of representation as transformation is very, very important in the arts. But I think there's an underlying theme that's very important, and it's a sort of conflict that is running through everything we've said, and it relates to the idea of patronage. And that is that, are we creating products as part of a commercial system? And those products are usually created by single figures, by individuals, who might or might not be a patron or an artist. Or are we thinking about something broader, which is not so easily financed or certainly measured, which is simply to do with, you know, the fashionable word, well-being. People actually feeling connected with one another, responsive, understood, recognized, allowed to be active. And that, I think, requires a fundamental philosophical and psychological shift in values. And they should stop doing all this outputs and impacts, and which is all through the academia, as you know, which is a scientific model of how to measure things, not altogether right for science either. It's pushing a lot of false science. People are making false proofs and so forth because they need to show that they've actually got a result instead of acknowledging that it's a failure, which is a very important thing to do, to say this is a false trail, we mustn't go down this trail anymore. So there's a conflict between, I'm afraid, neoliberal, commercial, corporate values of CEOs, sort of the artist CEO making some amazing thing that's very, very valuable, or this much more socialist idea of the cooperative. And, you know, we had a great figure who was a great artistic figure who did that. That was Joan Littlewood. Joan Littlewood in the, you know, 60s, 50s and 60s, with her Fun Palace, was a philosopher of play and community, and has left a legacy. She didn't quite succeed in everything she was trying to do, but she has left a legacy of sort of street theatre, community theatre. She put her stamp on that.
Thank you. John, any final comments before we move to questions?
Well, I think it's interesting that the period between 1997 and 2012 saw the biggest investment in arts in recent decades. It was called a golden era at the time, but we got so tied up with targets during that it stifled everything. And that was the beginning of something that could have been very good. And we've regressed again since then. And it's not looking very good.
There was a lot of capital,
yes.
A lot of buildings,
yeah.
But no running costs.
Indeed.
It needs to be the other way around.
Absolutely.
You need to have running costs, personnel, staff, and cheap spaces, not
the Millennium Dome.
Yeah.
So I'm keen to bring in our audience now, whether you wish to ask a question of the panel, whether you wish to challenge any of the consensus that has built up, I think, in these three discussions. If you are a neoliberal, this is your moment to come forward and stand up for your beliefs. And lady at the back will kick us off.
No pressure. Thank you very much for all your excellent contributions. My name's Maria. I work in the Department for International Development in the government. I was just reflecting on how we can create a sense of urgency for the role of arts in some of the big issues of today. And actually, climate change is another one that's really struck me. You know, all these Extinction Rebellion protests recently. And I really noticed in those the role of materials, arts, performance. And it did do something to capture imagination, I think. I think there's a role for us in government to join up between departments to help kind of bring a synthesis of ways of communication. But I just wondered if that sparked any ideas in you about how we might promote the arts within these urgent issues of the day.
Ben?
Thank you. I think that's a very timely example. And the capturing of attention is also the opening of a conversation. So the interventions, I mean, in lots of ways, protests are forms of performance art anyway, and very effective forms of protest are often very quite carefully choreographed. You know, they are performances. And they do, when they work, they do make huge difference to the way people think, and indeed just what's on their agenda mentally. So what you're, of course, protesting about can be good or bad, and there are some interesting examples. I had a PhD student recently who wrote about the very, very clever ways in which a certain extremely hyper-conservative church in America campaigns against gay personnel in the military in America. But he disagreed with them on every count, but was prepared to acknowledge that they were extremely good at performance art, even though he hated the message. So, you know, the tools can be distinguished, if you like, from the content in that respect. But the tools are worth paying attention to. And if the outcome of that is conversation rather than the shutting down of it, that is a public good. And I was very struck by the way that John used the language of a national conversation that was initiated by the establishing of the Philharmonic Society. I think many public art galleries are getting much better at creating conversations around exhibitions. So it's not just the exhibition, you just sort of put it out there and then that's that, and have a catalogue and that's the end of it. The events that are made possible, that the exhibition sort of stimulates, are often conversational events, which takes us right back to the origins of human wisdom in the Symposium, where conversation, it's not an output, except you can, if you're Plato, write a conversation down and share it. But that's the beginning of something. It's not the end. You know, the captured conversations ramify and people join in with them. So I'm hugely in favour of conversation as a term we might want to use as a goal of artistic interventions. And Extinction Rebellion is a good example of people who are making sure a conversation is happening that needs to happen.
Any other points on that one? Marina?
Well, I'm very glad to hear that from the Department of International Development you feel sympathetic. It's really good news. I think that it's not, one would be frightened of the government channeling this kind of energy for its own purposes at the moment, I'm afraid. That's my feeling. But especially as we have, you know, some elements of climate change deniers in the present regime. But I think if you could make available to young people or even the old people who've joined up to Extinction Rebellion, some means of actually bringing about the what they desire, that would be absolutely splendid. I wish you luck.
Okay, I'll take another question, if I may, at this point, and John will come back to you in a minute. Gentleman here.
My name's Alan Taylor. I'm a retired precision engineer. So this is a simple, short question. The words of Shakespeare and the music of Mozart and the drawings of Leonardo da Vinci are sublime. So my question is, what is the magic that elevates art to the sublime?
Well, who would like to tackle that particular one? I wonder whether we might come to Ben in a moment, given your background. John, how do you elevate things to the sublime in your life?
Well, it's invisible usually, and you can feel it happening. You can feel it happening in a hall of 500 children or a hall of 500 mixed audience. It's when the artist makes that connection. There's a sacred triangle between in music, between the composer, the artist, and the audience. And when that combines into something, in that shared experience, shared conversation, that can be transcendental. That's very special.
Thank you. Marina?
There is actually, in all three cases you brought up, it's not the case in every case of a great sublime artist, but it is the case of those three, which is they came out of communities that valued very, very highly what they were trying to do. Not as individuals, but theatre was the lifeblood of the city, and there were many acting companies, and Shakespeare was an actor. He was embedded in the compost of a shared endeavour. He happened to be completely brilliant at it, but that Leonardo, Florence, Milan, these were places where the artists were extremely highly valued, and they had workshops, they taught each other. You know, he came out of a workshop, and he himself had pupils, and your third one, Beethoven, hugely, hugely hospitable musical community in in Germany in particular, but here too.
In Vienna, when he was in poverty, public collections to help him to live, and the same in London. We sent him money from London.
I mean, the model of the soul genius, who's just somehow arrives like a meteor, is just not historically the case. You need to create hospitable compost.
Gosh, there's a strap line to conjure with. Ben, do you want to add anything?
That puts it beautifully. I couldn't add anything to that.
Fine. If we could have the microphone back at the front, there's a gentleman over here.
Alan Rayner, thank you for your talks. Very interesting. And my question to you is that in one thing the Department of Education has actually taken up now is what I call community creativity centres, so that every child in every town and every village can have access to a creative output rather than just a dictated syllabus that they have to pass exams.
So comments on that model, perhaps?
I think it chimes very much with the conversation that I had in Barking on Monday. To go into a borough where 60% of children are living in poverty, but where somehow the council has worked so hard, they've got a very, very good leader at the moment. There's a 93% attendance rate at school. So what they want us to do is to target in particular the non-attenders. And it could be somebody who's in a gang, it could be knife crime, it could be all this sort of thing, but finding ways of getting them to connect with their own story, with their own heritage, and with an art form, whatever it is, so that they feel a sense of place. And also I was struck by the fact that a lot of the young people there have never been to central London. They've never seen the Abbey. They've never seen the Tower of London. They don't leave their own borough, so they're in ghettos. They're neglected, there's all sorts of abuse and addiction. And enlightened councils can help change this with the arts. We can't transform the world, we've got to be careful about that. But we can make ourselves available to those who are open to it and maybe not fully realise it yet.
Okay, we might have time for one or two more questions. Natasha, your question.
Thank you so much. I can't think of a more interesting topic. The whole time I was listening to all three of you, I found myself thinking, what about turning it on its head when you talk about Palermo or Carnegie or Barking and saying, here we are with these wonderful facilities which we all enjoy. How can we as organisations go out to places, not necessarily Barking if they're already doing it, but the places that are not doing it? How do we find a way of it coming from you to them, not just waiting for them to ask you? You're clearly already doing quite a bit of this, but it does sadden me when I hear, whether it's VSO or NCVO, talking about places abroad where such wonderful things go on, like Palermo. There are these places in our city, and we're not reaching them.
Okay, perhaps a brief comment on that from each of you.
I think it's very... I couldn't be a more important aim. I do think my sense, particularly of art galleries, is that they are very concerned to try and do that. There's a limit to how much you can do if you're the custodian of paintings, as somewhere like the National Gallery might be, that are, you know, pricelessly valuable. You have to think very creatively about other ways to go to people with your resources, because there's a lot of attempt to bring people to the paintings, but actually there are also some quite interesting experiments in how to, without actually putting the paintings on the street, how to introduce people to them in contexts where they wouldn't expect. So a few years ago, the gallery, with the support of a very large corporate benefactor that was wanting to show off its own new powers of digital reproduction, so there was a sort of commercial interest at work there, but produced incredibly high quality reproductions of the works of art that were hung all over the country, outdoors actually. So they were really put onto the streets. And that was a way that people became aware of a collection that is their national collection. You know, that was part of the message. This belongs to everyone. It's a wonderful aspect of the National Gallery. It's not a royal collection. It's a public collection. And that was sort of manifested in the way that was pushed out onto the streets. And I think, you know, things like that work really well.
Just wanting more of it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What we need joined up national thinking, as I said earlier, we're all doing our own thing. We're all reaching tens of thousands of young people. And we're at capacity, we're at fundraising capacity. If you want, you know, for us to reach 10,000 people, we probably have to raise £500,000 privately. We do that, same with all the other institutions, but there's no overarching policy from government or from a society. Something needs to lead this and coordinate it. Otherwise, we will only hit pockets. Hmm. That's fine, but it's not good enough.
Can I just say that the Department of Education is actually taking up the community creativity centres? I have it in letter in writing.
I mean, I've come across a lot of different organisations. I mean, I do agree with John that it needs to be more joined up. But actually, it's quite fertile having... They're all very different. Some of them are religious. Some of them are theatrical, for example, street theatre. Some of them are strict refugee agencies, little ones in different towns. Some of them are individuals, just a group that's trying to do something, have tea parties for local displaced people. So, I mean, there's an immense amount of goodwill. I mean, there really is. And it's quite extraordinary how many people want the society to flourish better than it is now and see this form of activity as something that does bind people. We were talking about that, bind people a little bit more closely and warmly together. I worry a little bit about central directive from government. A little bit, I do. I mean, and also because I think it's very hard to get away from this idea of measurements. And, you know, one of the reasons that we were able to get off the ground in Palermo is that it just happened spontaneously. I mean, there's a cafe where a lot of displaced people gather, and we just began doing it there, and then it just grew. And so there was no... You know, there was a spontaneous kind of warmth. And actually, though Palermo is actually a very well-run city with a very, very good mayor, who's an excellent man of great integrity, it is in chaos because, you know, they've had thousands and thousands of immigrants. So that in a way, it's much looser. You know, we did have to get permission to use the street, but, you know, otherwise it's quite easy going. You can, and of course, the weather makes it easy to do things outside.
Very good. Time for one last question, and then I will have to draw things to a conclusion.
Thank you very much. It's Gillian Dare. I've worked in all major sectors, business, local and central government, and international relations. And I say one of the things that has struck me over the years is that policymakers in any of the areas are basically averse to change and challenge. And we more or less agreed, I think, around here, that the arts offer opportunities for stimulating the imagination, creativity, passion and compassion. What I think we need to do is offer the arts in those ways to more people who are making public policy, because that's where you get the answers to the what-if questions of our society, where we're going, what sort of society we want to be in. And I noticed I used to be on the education board of the Royal Opera House, and it suddenly dawned on us that nearly all the leadership and team-building things came from the sports. Then we started to offer opera as that, and we stimulated completely different approaches to the companies that we were working with. And I think we could do that on a much wider scale across a lot of different areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Last word, perhaps, from each of our speakers to send us on our way with a happy skip and a step. John, do you want to?
Well, I think that we're doing more of this than ever. All arts organisations are beginning to find their niche, find their community and tell their story, and that's wonderful. We just need to find ways of reaching more people.
Indeed.
Risk, I guess, is the thing that risk-averse societies, risk-averse organisations, and risk-averse businesses often end up failing. And one of the ways in which, as Marina was saying about the sciences, in which you progress and come up with new perspectives and new ideas is by failing. So I think, you know, if we had an arts culture that could model the benefits of risk and indeed of failure, then we would all have something to learn from that, you know, even in ordinary life. So the things the arts can model in that particular respect have transferable wisdom to every aspect of human life. My brother-in-law runs a festival called Omodernt in Sweden, and they do all kinds of extremely risky things, like play music while somebody balances rocks on stage. And the experiments that they do, every single concert they do, it seems to me, is an experiment. And they're incredibly exciting events to attend, and the rocks might fall over, and the musicians have to be nimble to jump out of the way.
But one of the things is that they have absolutely no measurements for that. And so what needs to be rethought is how things are assessed for their value. Because the only way you could do it is if you factored in pleasure, desire, laughter into these measurements. And I mean, I remember a long time ago, there was a very famous survey done by Amartya Sen, the great economist, into GNP and how they were measured. And he realized that women had been left out because they don't actually, in India, they didn't actually go out to work and earn a salary, so they weren't being put in the GNP. And he readjusted the way it was measured by putting in all the work women did at home. And this, of course, utterly changed both the value of women, how they were seen by economists, but also how the GNP itself was seen.
Thank you very much. You've just given us another two-word buzz phrase. You've given us two during the course of the day. Transferable wisdom, I think, is what we've experienced in the last hour or so. And I'd like to thank very much our three speakers for all that they've contributed to our transferable wisdom through their contribution. So do join me in thanking them for their...